Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Sliding Into My DMs. How's it going?
Oh, it has been my gosh.
Forever.
So this is what a wish spell feels like.
Yeah.
It's only been like 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
This is season two.
Right. And yeah, this is season two, right?
We had higher production values.
Well, I don't know about
character
that.
Story arcs.
Let me introduce my DMs.
I have no clue who I am.
With us today, we have Tori, the dungeon mistress. We've got Dallin, the Blackthorn Rogers, and Corey, the Grand Poobah, the Ogma. I won't call you Ogma.
Might as well. No. Yep, I am Ogma, and he is okay. Me.
Right. So for those who have been asking, thank you for your patience. As I sort of took a little hiatus, this is the show on the D4 network, which is basically like a talk show. We talk about D&D news. We talk about D&D rules. Yep. And then we talk about tips and tricks and, give advice for, or just, I guess, have a conversation about how to make sure that everybody at the table is having as much fun as they possibly can. So, maybe I'll just fill people in, since this is sort of the more casual, informal show that I guess I do on the channel. Part of the big reason for not having a Sliding Into My DMs episode for a while is because at the beginning of the year, I actually quit my day job. I haven't announced that anywhere or anything like that. And so I guess, first of all, huge thanks to, all of the viewers and subscribers and channel members and things that helped me get there. And actually to you guys too, because you've helped me in your own ways to kind of grow the channel. So thanks to everybody. It's been awesome, but also at the same time, I've been spending, well, for the first, sorry, you guys were like, I thought this was Sliding Into My DMs, not like a history of Colby. I just feel like I need to fill people in at some point.
It's important.
Like for the first year and a half that I was doing the YouTube channel, I was basically trying to hold down a full-time job and do the channel on the side. And it was like, I was working 60 hours a week and spending all of my nights and weekends doing like the YouTube stuff for the most part. And since quitting my job and trying to just focus on the channel full time, I've tried to like not bring it home with me and be able to actually spend time with my wife and kids and things like that.
What? You get to do that?
I know, it's crazy. But it's been really nice, but it's also, I've been trying to get like a buffer on my character build episodes, right? Because previously I was like burning the midnight oil until 2 a.m. the night before the video was supposed to come out, like editing it and getting it uploaded and ready and da 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 da. And I'm like really tired of that. I want to like actually have it done like ideally a week before it releases, right? And so I've just been like trying to work really hard during the days to kind of get ahead. And I feel like I'm finally to that point now. So hopefully we could kind of bring Sliding Into My DMs back. So that was a very long explanation as to why there's been such a
delay. Tori just got so bored, she just left.
Yeah, I know. It's like blah, blah, blah.
Like blah, blah, yeah, Colby time.
Before.
Yada, yada. Wife and kids, whatever.
Anyways.
Are you ragging on wife and kids?
No, I'm a wife. We were ragging on you for leaving during the conversation.
Sorry, I didn't want a barking dog.
So, quick note, we have, the last several episodes, we've been trying to record them sort of live in person as opposed to on Zoom, like we're doing now and we had been doing. And I prefer to do them live. I like being with you guys when we talk. I feel like it's kind of a better chemistry, but we just didn't have a great place to record. There's lighting issues and audio issues and things like that. So I decided to just take it back to Zoom for a little bit, maybe hopefully we can solve that in the future. But apologies if you're not a big fan of the Zoom format, and I know the audio isn't great. I don't even have my good microphone with me here in the office. But anyway, right. Let's jump in. So we always do, well, we almost always do two things, right? Insight into my DMs. First, a quick ruling. Quick ruling is, you know, I pick a rule, something that's been bugging me, something that people have been asking me about. I'm not quite sure how to interpret rules as written, and I want to find out from my DMs about it. And then I will do a deep dive conversation into a larger topic, which we'll get to momentarily. So first up, the quick ruling. Can Tortles, the playable race for players, benefit in any way?
They exist
also like in the Monster Manual. So I'm just saying, like, okay, the player race version, Tortles, can they benefit in any way, shape, or form from armor of any kind? So, little background. A few weeks ago, I did a video on a Bladesinger tank, and my initial plan with the character was to make them a Tortle. But I kind of ran into an apparent conflict anyway when I was reading a little more closely on the Tortle and read this passage under their natural armor feature, where it says, your shell provides ample protection. However, it gives you a base armor class of 17. Your dexterity modifier doesn't affect this number. You gain no benefit from wearing armor. But if you're using a shield, you can use the shield's bonus as normal. And I thought, well, I was planning on multiclassing the turtle with an armorer. And I'm like, how do we interpret that no benefit clause there? Because if it just means they don't gain any AC benefit, well, maybe we can make it work anyway and it might be worth it. But if it's like you cannot wear armor at all, or at the very least you can't benefit it from armor in any way, not just the AC, right, then it doesn't work. And so I wanted to ask you guys about it and say, all right, what does it mean here? What does it mean? So as always, I want your interpretation first, rules as written, and then how you would rule it at your table. So rules as written, first off, what do they mean? What do Wizards of the Coast mean? How do we interpret rules as written, this you gain no benefit from wearing armor? Does that just mean you cannot, your AC cannot benefit, or like you basically can't equip it, or maybe you can equip it, but if it's magic armor that lets you maybe cast a spell or something like that, like, nope, sorry, like that's a benefit to armor and you don't get it because you're a turtle. Or if you're an armorer artificer, you know, and we read, you can customize your arcane armor. The model you choose gives you special benefits while you wear it, right? So can we wear it? And if so, can we not benefit from any special benefits because we're a turtle? What do you think?
So there's an important extra step here in under the magic items category in the DMG. It says, unless an armor's description says otherwise, armor must be worn in order or for its magic to function. So rules as written, you have to wear the armor to get the benefit from it. And if you cannot get benefits from wearing armor, it would stand to reason that rules as written, turtles cannot gain benefits from magical armor. So the armor trait would also fall under that category. That being said, the armorer was developed after the turtle. Mm-hmm. So at my table, I would, if somebody came up to me and said, I want to play an armorer turtle, I'd be like, sure, custom lineage it, and then call it good there, because there's no reason not to. Like, it's one of those minor things where you're literally handicapping yourself in order to play a turtle. I don't understand it. So just, yeah. Or you know what, your natural shell is now your armor, and that's what you get to enchant, and that you know provides your benefits, which I think that's the cooler option of the two. But
yeah,
that's just at my table.
Yeah, I like that. All right, what do you think, Tori? Rules as written.
Yeah, I am on the exact same page as Corey here. Okay. But I do love the idea of watching a turtle put on some armor. You know,
take a extra long time.
It's like Can you take out the back part of this plate for me? Just like this whole suit of armor, you right. know, like going up to like a tailor or leather worker and being like, I need this custom fit for me. And they're like, no way.
I imagine like on Big Hero 6 when they're putting Baymax in his armor and they're like,
trying to squeeze.
That's what I imagine it looks like.
You know, it does say, I mean, speaking about the armorer specifically, the armor attaches to you and can't be removed against your will. It also expands to cover your entire body, although you can retract or deploy the helmet as a bonus action. It replaces any missing limbs, functioning identically to a limb it replaces. So I almost envision like the armorer's armor anyway, as like a Tony Stark spider suit. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it just does whatever it needs to kind of cover you. And maybe that works a little better with a turtle than like your traditional plate mail, right? Or like a magical suit of half plate or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, magic exists in the world. Like, there's no reason to think that a turtle couldn't also be an armor artificer.
What do you think, Dallin?
I unfortunately agree with both of them. So blame for content. I know. But I would say as a DM, there's lots of ways around it. I think you could talk to your player if there's a specific piece of armor that they're trying to get just the benefit from other than AC. Maybe you work it into a weapon or a scarf or I don't know.
Turn
just,
it into a wondrous item.
Exactly. Sure. Just homebrew it a little bit so it can work. I don't think you need to handicap anyone from playing a turtle because then they're going to just choose elf or something. And that's, that gets old.
Boring.
Yeah. Elves are boring.
I'm removing all of you from this. Right
now. You want conflict.
Okay. I like that. Thank you. I think I especially like the custom lineage suggestion because I'm always looking for reasons to defend me taking custom lineage all the time. So
honestly, at this point, it's probably just like my future campaigns might just be like pick custom lineage and then just be whatever race you want to be. Just to make it easy on everybody.
Or alternatively, you could do what a lot of people do at their tables, I think, which is just tell everybody you can have a free feat. Everybody gets a free feat, and then but you can't be custom lineage unless you really want to play something weird that doesn't fit otherwise. You know what I mean? Like, but custom lineage doesn't get a free feat or whatever. I don't know. That way. Yeah. I think that kind of opens up that's another way anyway, to sort of open up the spectrum. Yeah.
Or maybe I'll go the other way and I'll just be stricter and be like, nope, no custom lineage, but no free feat. Why not?
Corey? Yeah. I don't want to play at your table anymore. <I'm just
kidding. laughs> That's the goal. Too oppressive.
every DM's goal is to make people not want to play with them anymore, right? That's what we're supposed to do.
That's how I understand it. That's how you win D&D.
I cannot play this new subclass at somebody else's table if I am DMing the games. I want to play this new subclass that we're going to talk about.
All right, nice segue. So let's jump in to the deep dive conversation, which today is going to be all about the world of Kryn. And for the uninitiated, that means Dragonlance. For those who don't know, a few weeks ago, Wizards of the Coast released some new Unearthed Arcana, the Heroes of Kryn. We've kind of speculated in past sliding into my DMs episodes, right, about there being a Dragonlance book in the work, and I think, you know, to nobody's surprise,
we are soothsayers.
Yes, to nobody's surprise, we are prophets.
So I actually have to say that I was a little surprised because I thought that they were just going to be like, here's Fizz Bands, it incorporates some Dragonlance stuff. And I thought they were going to call it good there. But I guess they did say that they were going to talk about, they were going to talk about some new or some familiar planes. And I guess it shouldn't be surprising.
We're going to see a full book for sure. I don't think this is just going to be like add on. Like this is going to be a full
book, I think.
So
here's what I would like to do. I want to give a kind of a brief primer overview really quick on Kryn and Dragonlance. And then I want to break down this Unearthed Arcana sort of piece by piece. There's a new race that was introduced. There's a new subclass that was introduced. And then there are a couple of new backgrounds that come along with some new feats. And so I want to talk about all those things and just sort of not just to talk about them for the sake of talking about them, but do a little analysis on them, maybe, you know, kind of decide if we think in their current state, they're underpowered, balanced, or overpowered. So sound good?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay. For the uninitiated, Kryn is the world where the Dragonlance novels take place. And these books were written in like the late 80s with Dragonlance Chronicles. And then they went Legends and then Tales and Heroes and all kinds of, you know, they branched out in a million different ways. I was a huge fan when I was like in junior high. And I read them voraciously and repeatedly. In fact, when I was playing with my friends, you know, AD&D first edition, I guess, or whatever AD&D was, they came out with a Dragonlance book back then, even, and I remember being so excited, and we instantly like started incorporating it into our sessions, right? And one of my good friends, Ethan, he's probably not watching, but if he is, he played a Kender. Tori's going to talk about the Kender and just drove me freaking crazy. He played the Kender perfectly. He basically is like a human Kender. Like he's, oh, anyway.
Sad.
No, it's not sad. I mean, he loves
to. It's an insult. I'll share my thoughts on that soon.
Anyway. So yeah, you know, you had these heroes that told this great story. And in fact, for those who don't know, the original chronicles, the original novels were basically like a bunch of friends sitting down playing D&D, and they kind of all looked at each other and were like, you know what, this would make a good book. We should write this, right? And then they did. And nowadays we all just turn it into YouTube videos or podcasts.
Yep.
So they were like,
speaking of which, check out Tales of an Area.
Tales of an Area. If you want to see our, oh boy, hands. Okay, there we go. Whew, that was rough.
Right.
Yeah, our actual play channel there. But anyway, so frankly, I don't know if they were like, hey, let's write a book about a D&D session, and then they sat down to play and took copious notes, or if they like played and they were like, gosh, you know what, this would make a great book, let's like novelize it. I'm sure there are plenty of people watching who know better than I do. But anyway, you know, Fizban came from that. He's sort of the god of light in that world, the Platinum Dragon. And everything that we're getting here really harkens back to like a very important character in the world of Dragonlance, and even in those first books, those chronicles. So yeah, let's jump in.
Let's do it
really quickly. You know, we get a little bit of a preamble at the beginning that's essentially the same as any other that we've had over the last several months, right? Ability score increases. This is kind of the standard now. Everybody, every race can either pick a +2 in something and then a +1 in something, or a +1 in three things. And then it talks about, you know, most creatures are humanoids, but you might be something else. And here's all the potential creature types that there are. And you can choose a language, blah, 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 you know, lifespan, height and weight, kind of all rote stuff at this point. But then they introduce the new race. So Tori, tell us about the Kender.
Okay. So think of a Kender as a naive yet naturally, well, cleverly curious kleptomaniac halfling with a penchant for wanderlust and fearlessness. They actually sound really fun to play. I'm not going to lie. They kind of remind me of an annoying little brother a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Perfect for me. I am that annoying little brother.
You are an annoying little brother. That's perfect. I think all three of you are annoying little brothers, aren't you? No? Hey, Dallin, you're an older
little
brother.
I'm the oldest. Yes.
Annoying. Well, yeah, okay. Fine.
Yeah. I have a family of kinders underneath me.
There you go. So you're related to, yeah. I am related to two.
Yep.
But they sound so fun. So their pockets are always filled with like little trinkets and curiosities that they've stolen from other people. But the thievery is never like malicious. It's always just chalked up to like interest. Like, well, this was an interesting thing. And like, it's a good thing I found it, or someone else would have stolen it, you know, type thing, which I love.
I have to comment here because I love the way that they sort of phrased this aspect of Kenders in the book. I hope it stays, because in the books, right, Tasselhoff Lightfoot, he's like the main character, the main Kender character, at least in Chronicles, and he's very much the way that you just described Kenders. And that's sort of, well, what I assumed to be like a running gag in, you know, throughout the Dragonlance books, of like Flint, his friend, or somebody else being like, hey, like, where did you get that thing? And he's always, without fail, like, totally innocent, like, I have no idea how this got in my pockets. You know what I mean? Like, and the joke was sort of like, haha, like, he's such a kleptomaniac or whatever. Like, he literally steals things without even knowing that he's stealing them. Right.
Yeah.
But the way that they put it here is so great. It's almost like Wizards of the Coast is buying into the narrative that Kenders always tell, right? That like, stuff just magically appears in their pockets, right? Instead of like they steal stuff, right? Which I love. Yeah, unknown to most mortals, a magical phenomenon surrounds a Kender. Spurred by their curiosity and love for trinkets, blah blah blah, a Kender's pouches or pockets will be magically filled with these objects. No one knows where these objects come from.
Not even
the Kender. This has led many Kender to be misplaced as thieves when they fish these items out of their pockets. So yeah, that's
somebody was like a huge stan of Mr. Lightfoot, and they're like, no, he wasn't a thief.
Yeah.
He said he wasn't. Right. This is a magical phenomenon, and we're gonna make it canon in the book.
Yes.
Yeah, I love it.
I actually have a really quick fun fact. The Kender was one of the races they were testing out when they were calling D&D 5th edition D&D Next. When they first send out like the playtest packets for it, one of the races you could beat was Kender.
Really?
And they just dropped it for the more basic races. But I was a little disappointed because I loved the idea of this magical trinket pocket dimension, you know, wielding maniac.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're amazing.
It sounds like Bilbo, but Bilbo with more chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I would say with pointy ears, usually a top knot hair, and like thinner than halflings, I would say almost like a miniature elf, as
what's
opposed to a miniature
in my pocket
human.
I don't even know. I don't know the answer to this riddle.
Is that a flute in your pocket?
No, that's my embarrassing story, and I was not last at the meeting, so I don't have to tell it.
Sorry.
Perfect.
Oh yeah, sorry, Dallin, you have to tell an embarrassing story for your last meeting. I decided that today. So can't wait to hear what it is. Moving on, there are a few like noticeable features that you get as a Kender. They're naturally brave, and so they had advantage on saving throws against being frightened, which is awesome. They're also, like we said, natural born like button pushers and can easily get under the skin of their enemies, and so they get the taunt feature. And again, it honestly makes me think of my younger brother, the one just younger than me. Like, he just knows the things to say and do.
we finally have an official taunt in D&D.
Yeah.
Right. I always build tank characters, and I talk about like how, you know, in video games, the way that it typically works is the tank has this ability that's usually called taunt, and then it sort of forces the bad guy to attack them and not other people, right? And they don't really have that in D&D, and actually still don't. I mean, this isn't that, right?
Yeah.
But at least it's called taunt. The weird thing about the taunt feature, how they have it here, to me, is like it functions similarly to other taunt like things that already exist in D&D, in that it imposes disadvantage, right? They mm-hmm. get flustered and they have disadvantage on attacks, but they don't like have any increased desire to attack the Kendur themselves, which you would think they might. But I guess, you know, Wizard of the Coast just doesn't want to, like, mechanically force the DM to say, okay, my monster now has to attack this player, right? And I get it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just thought it was interesting.
So what exactly does the ability do then?
So if a creature fails its wisdom saving throw against the Kendur's taunt, it has disadvantage on attack rolls until the start of the Kendur's next turn.
And is it's a bonus action?
Mm-hmm. Bonus action.
But you can only do it, proficiency bonus times per day, like pretty much everything that we're seeing these days, which I think is a great sort of scaling, you know, limited.
It means that if you're playing a Kendur, you better get some choice taunts ready.
That's right.
Get a list prepared. That's right. Like that's,
yeah. Those suckers are ready for sure.
Yeah.
So I love that. And then the other kind of fun thing that they have is, so this little magical ability that, and this goes with kind of their like kleptomaniac personality, that it's called the Kendur Ace. And so as a bonus action, the Kendur can pull an object out of a pouch. And this could be during combat or during just gameplay. And it's based on a roll table. And it would just make for so much fun. I just love it. I mean, the things that you pull out of the pouch are like not that like impressive, right? It's like, here's a simple weapon, or like here's, and the whatever you pull out of there, it's like glimmering, and then it vanishes after an hour. But I love the idea of like, oh, let me see what I pull out of here. You're not going to know what it is until you roll your die. But maybe it's gold, and you pay for something with that,
and then it disappears. More chaos.
I love it.
Anytime,
it's like, so fun.
It drives me crazy, of course, because in my head I'd be like, oh, I could really use some gold to pay for something, but like I got a 1 in 6 chance, and it's like, oh yeah. I got a dagger.
So you can use this a number of times equal your proficiency per day too.
Yep.
Which could make for a situation where the team is like, we really need like a crowbar right now, we're trapped in this jail cell, and they all turn to the Kendur, and the Kendur's like starts like pulling things out of their pockets. It's just like, come on.
That is pretty great. And if you think about it in that way, like if you save this right for when you really need it and you're not in the middle of combat or whatever, then yeah, I mean, sure, you might be able to roll 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 times, and then there's a pretty decent chance that you'll actually get what you need, right?
I love it. So I definitely want to play a Kendur. I think they are so fun, and it'd be so fun for role play.
Feels like it pairs with a bard really nicely.
Oh, totally.
Bard or like a rogue, I think.
I can actually see it pairing with a wizard really well too, because you just got these like magical trinkets.
Yeah, or whatever, some like you're just kooky like, wizard, like lost his mind to books long ago.
get a robe of useful items to throw on top of that, just to be like, just to be completely random.
Yeah, totally. You'd be like you could do the chaos sorcerer or the wild magic sorcerer. Yeah. Sorry.
Yep.
Yes.
Do you think they are underpowered, balanced, or overpowered?
Probably. I mean, there's nothing like incredibly special about them. I'd say maybe a little underpowered.
My dog is having a heart attack. That's sort of my impression as well. But that said, like, the power of races really varies widely, right? Like there's plenty of existing races in D&D that are no more powerful than, you know, this Kendur Ace, Brave, and Taunt features that Kendurs get. And plenty that I would say are like maybe less impressive, right? But then there are others that like really kind of bring a lot to the table. So, I mean, it's not, I guess I would say, I don't think it's without the sort of existing, whatever, you know, power, what's the word I'm looking for?
Spread.
Range.
Spread. It's in the curve. It's right there in the curve.
Yeah. But yeah, yeah. I do. I guess like you, I don't know that I see it as being like super strong, right? Cool, flavorful, fun, no doubt. Corey, tell us about the new sorcerer subclass.
So why would you want to play a chaos sorcerer when you can have lunar magic?
Seriously.
So as everybody knows, sorcerers happen when a mom and a dad really love each other. There's one of them has extreme magical power. or is a god or an archdevil or just a manifestation of chaos, or in this case, somebody sunbathes in moonlight for a long time, or I guess moonbathes in this case. So someone from your lineage have been exposed to the connection or the concentrated magic of the moon or moons, if your world that you create has multiple, and it imbues you with lunar magic. First things first, you obviously pick manifestations for your lunar magic, which can be anything you want, obviously, but they give you recommendations like you glow with a faint light that matches the color of the moon of your world. Your pupils, this is my favorite, the pupils shift in shape matching the current phase of the moon on your world, cool. Which I think is really awesome. And then there's some other cool ones in there, but of course, these are just like suggestions of like, just to make sure that your sorcerer magic shows itself, because that always happens. At first level, you get Moonfire, which lets you cast the Sacred Flame cantrip. But importantly, it doesn't count as a number against the number of cantrips, you know. And when you cast the spell, you can target one creature or two creatures that are within 5 feet of each other, which I think is really cool, is you kind of get a cantrip AoE sort of.
Yeah, that's something that when I read it, I was like, you know, I could see myself like trying to do a build around that feature. I've done a number of like multi-target damage characters that are sort of built specifically to try and do damage to multiple targets, right? And it's hard to do that in a sustained fashion. But this is one that would lend itself to that. Sacred Flame is not an amazing like cantrip damage wise, so
doubling the damage on it at level one,
the dead is better, and death clerics can toll the dead onto characters that are within 5 feet of them of each other as well, you know. So anyway, of course, that's where my brain goes.
We're literally getting an insight into the process here.
Yeah. But anyway, still cool and unique, right?
Yeah. And then the other thing that you get at level one is all sorcerers, I believe, get like an extra like set of spell lists based on their origin. But what's really interesting and unique about the lunar sorcerer is that when you finish a long rest, you pick one of three spell lists in order to draw from. You can either pick full moon spells, which deal with things like fairy fire, moonbeam, you know, death ward, cure mass wounds, kind of more the healing side of the moon, of the aspects of the moon. You can pick new moon spells, which are things like dissonant whispers, darkness, and bestow curse, you know, basically things that go bump in the night when the moon isn't out. And then crescent moon spells have to deal with like illusions, hallucinatory terrain, phantom steed, dream, blindness, deafness, that sort of thing. So you pick one of those lists each time you take a long rest, and then later on, which we'll get to in just a moment here, you can switch that during the day as well.
I love that. I think it's so cool.
Yeah. I think it's my favorite aspect of this subclass, right? It's like, it reminds me of, for people who played like say World of Warcraft, or I'm sure a bunch of other games that function similarly, you pick a character and you have like three talent trees. Well, this is how it used to work anyway. I don't know if it's still this way, but, and basically you spec your character out based on like, you know, which talent trees you take. Well, I'm like an assassin rogue, or I'm a combat rogue, or I'm a subtlety rogue, or whatever. And for a long time anyway, like once you picked, you were locked in, right? Later on, they gave you the ability to respec. And this is almost like respec light in D&D, where it's like, hey, you can like, maybe today you feel like being a full moon spell and being like a healer support type, but like maybe tomorrow you want to be more damage focused, or, you know, whatever, then maybe you would go with new moon, that kind of thing. And that's cool. I like
now,
that.
Now, one more thing to note with this, because that's very important. While you are in the chosen phase, spells of the associated phase in the lunar spell list can be cast once without expending the spell slot. So you get one free use of fairy fire, moonbeam, death ward, freedom of movement, mass cure wounds every day if you go full moon. And from the looks of it, if you can change your phase during the same day, you get the other spells too, once for free. That's what I'm reading here, but I'm not exactly sure.
Because I didn't think about that.
Yeah, because it says that once you cast a spell in this way, you can't do so again until you finish the long rest. But that is each spell. It says spells of the associated phase can be cast once. So, and then once you hit level 6 and you get lunar lunar boons, you get to use a sorcerer point to switch. Was it level 6? Yeah, as a bonus action, you can spend one sorcery point. Sorry, it's waxing and waning is the feature, not lunar boons. Lunar boons is something different. Yeah. So level 6, you can spend a sorcery point as a bonus action and switch the phase to a different one, which means you get a total of like at 9th level, when you reach it, you get a total of like 12 different spells that you can cast once for free. Now, granted, having
18 actually, or no, 15.
Yeah, having Phantom Steed once for free is not always going to be great, and you know some of these spells are kind of, they're okay in only certain situations, but that's still a lot of spells, and I don't know, there needs to be some clarification on that, because 12 spells for free is insane.
Yeah, that seems a little bit much.
I feel like it's probably the first one that you pick, you get those spells for free until a long rest. I don't know that it would be every time, but they don't specify. So.
Yeah, I could also see it being when you cast Fairy Fire, your first level spell, if you switch to the New Moon, you cannot cast a first level.
That makes sense, locks them in.
Like, I could see that as well.
That said,
that's pretty complex for D&D. It's like a whole like new tracking mechanic almost.
Exactly.
That said, it does require a sorcery point to switch to a new lunar phase, right? And so yes, they're free, but they're not quite free. Now, granted, having five spells for one sorcery point is a great deal, but at the same time, like, you might not need freedom of movement in a day, right? Or mislead, or, you know, I don't know, whatever. Like, I'm sure if you could cast it for free, you'd maybe find a use for it, right? But I don't know.
So
I'll be curious to see.
You do have an abundance of sorcery points, more so than other sorcerers, though, because whenever you are when at level 6, your lunar booms activate. I'm going to call it lunar booms from now on. And it basically says that lunar phases influence your meta magic. Each lunar phase is associated with a spell or with spells of the following school of magic. For the full moon, it's abjuration and conjuration. New moon, it's evocation and necromancy. And then crescent moon, it's divination and transmutation. And whenever you use a meta magic feature on a spell from the lunar spells table or a spell of the school of magic associated with the lunar phase you are in, you can reduce the sorcery point cost by 1 to a minimum of 0. It specifies that minimum of 0 in there, probably to be like, you cannot regain sorcery points this way.
Yeah.
I will point out one more caveat to that, is that you can only reduce the number of sorcery points spent a number of times equal to your proficiency bonus. So it's not every single spell, or else that would be even more overpowered. But yeah, still being able to do that 3 or 4 times a day is pretty powerful. And then so we talked about waxing and waning as the 6th level feature. Level 14, you get lunar empowerment, which all of their things are lunar. Like, they need to kind of, that's one thing they should workshop, is not everything needs to have lunar in front of it. We know you're a lunar sorcerer. But basically, it just says that whenever you choose a lunar phase to affect your magic, you also gain an additional benefit. For the full moon, you shed bright light in a 10-foot radius and dim light an additional 10 feet. And in addition, you and creatures of your choice have advantage on saving throws while you're in the bright light you shed, which is very good. Advantage on saving throws is incredible. It's even better than the plus whatever that paladins give you.
Yeah.
I think that would depend on what saving throw and what your current score is and what the paladin's charisma is.
I almost would take a guaranteed plus than advantage, but
or you could just do both and do a walking fortress still, right? Which, by the way, that is my new name for Eve, is the walking fortress, because literally everybody just sticks around her so that you can get the benefits of that.
This is a 14th level feature, so I guess technically if you were a paladin 6 and a sorcerer 14, you could then give everyone within 10 feet of you a bonus to their saving throws based on your constitution or your charisma and advantage, which that would be, but that's a level 20 character, but still, just get a sorcerer and a paladin and they could be best friends.
Exactly. And then at level 18, you get Lunar Phenomenon,
Wait. No, before you go on to lunar phenomenon, tell the lunar empowerment. We just talked about the full moon benefit.
What's I apologize. Yeah. That's the only one I really care about is the full moon. Apparently, the new moon gives you advantage on stealth checks. And in addition, when you are in dim light or darkness, your attack rolls have a disadvantage against you, which is a great, Yep. Which is great for it. Cause you do get darkness as a new moon spell, a third level one. So,
Thinking of like
Shadow
coupling this with a Twilight cleric, who can just make dim light right around them.
Yeah.
And therefore,
again, this is like a level 14 version. So yeah.
Yeah. But still that's
nice. And then Crescent Moon is kind of your halfway between them. So you have resistance to necrotic and radiant damage, basically the dark damage
and the bad damage. Yeah.
Yep. Sorry. Now lunar phenomenon. Basically, when you enter a lunar phase, the magic bursts out. As a bonus action, you can tap into the special power of the lunar phase you are currently in. Alternatively, as part of the bonus action you take to change your lunar phase while you're with your waxing and waning feature, you can immediately use the power of the lunar phase you are entering. So full moon, you radiate intense moonlight for a moment. You basically become a flashbang. Each creature of your choice within 30 feet must make a constitution saving throw against your spell save DC or be blinded until the end of its next turn. And then in addition, one creature of your choice in that area can regain 3d8 hit points, which is really cool. I always like the idea of making a sorcerer an off healer. So that's really fun. The new moon, you momentarily emanate an oppressive gloom. Each creature of your choice within 30 feet of you must succeed on a dexterity saving throw against your spell save DC or take 3d10 necrotic damage and have its speed reduced to zero until the end of its next turn. And in addition, you become invisible until the end of your next turn or until you make an attack or cast a spell, which is fantastic to get a free constitution free invisibility for at least a turn, right?
You mean concentration.
Concentration
free, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that is that I think is probably the we'll see about Crescent Moon, but that's more powerful, I think, anyway, than the lunar phenomenon. Although, you know, blind is great, but constitution saving throw, a lot of monsters, especially at level 18, are going to have a high con save. So I just don't know how often that will actually work, but
yeah, the healing is nice too,
though. Yeah. Anyway,
and then finally in Crescent Moon, you slip through light and darkness. You magically teleport to an unoccupied space you can see within 60 feet. And in addition, you gain resistance to all damage until the start of your next turn. As a bonus action, you get to basically, it's a free Misty Step coupled with Stone Skin Plus, I suppose.
Yeah, that's quite good. And it's a 60-foot teleport too. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, so it's a double Misty Step.
Now, this is, as a bonus action, you can tap into a special power of the lunar phase you are currently in. So you would just use a bonus action to do this.
Yes. So you use a bonus action.
Proficiency number times proficiency a day. Bonus times a day?
So once you use a phase's bonus action, you can't do so again until you finish the long rest. Or if you spend 5 sorcery points to use it.
Okay.
Expensive.
That's pretty limited.
So it's limited, which is good.
But again, you could use all 3 in a single day with 3 sorcery points, or 2 rather, because you get it whenever you switch phases, you can choose to activate it then as well. So you can use a bonus action, spend a sorcery point, go from full moon, which you've already used, into new moon to deal damage.
Yeah, once you use a phase's bonus action, you can't. It doesn't say you can only use lunar phenomenon once per day.
Once, yeah. Yep. It's
so you could do each of these with a sorcery point once per day. Yeah. Gives a lot of versatility. It's pretty complex, like you were saying, Dallin, but I like that, right?
Yeah.
It's cool to have to think about a lot of options. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is really cool to like have this kind of very flexible sorcerer on hand where you can literally be like, I think we need a little bit of extra healing to get through this thing. So I'm going to switch to full moon phase and then free cast mass cure wounds. And then I can switch back to new moon and do some damage based on that, kind of thing. Hmm. Like it allows you to kind of weave a role in battle that most sorcerers are kind of limited to. I do one thing and that's hit you with a magic hammer until you're dead kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. So do you think it's underpowered, overpowered, or balanced?
I think it's a little bit overpowered right now. especially if what I'm reading about the spells is true, because getting a free one of 12 spells, no matter how you kind of, oh, it's not even 12, it's 15 different spells once for free, is that's a little much.
Yeah, that would be good for a warlock, like a sorcerer. Like you're decent with your spell slots already.
Yeah. I could see them reining that in a little bit for sure. But I don't know. It looks pretty cool. It looks interesting. I like all the versatility.
I will say that just based on the flavor, this is my next character, and I think I might just play a Kender with it, because why not? Just throw a Kender in there. But like if we ever play a game where I get to play like a full campaign, I will be playing probably a lunar magic Kender, just because love it.
Yeah. Happy St. Patrick's Day, by the way. And I am virtually pinching each one of you because
green.
Everybody's wearing, that's not green. That's like,
this is green. I also am drinking you can't see it. A green drink.
I am not wearing green. That's fine.
My hat is also green camo, so reverse your pinch.
I think
you get to pinch him 10 times.
Virtually.
That's the rule.
Is that the rule?
I think like certain shades of green have to qualify.
It's like lime. Lime green, basically.
Are you gatekeeping St. Patrick's Day?
100%.
You're not even Irish. You're like,
as the only one here who has lived in Ireland, I reserve the right to make that decision.
My great grandfather, his name was Patrick himself, would disagree. And I'm not lying, that was his name, and he was from Ireland. So
All right. Let's jump in then to the background. So, we've got Kender Tasselhoff. We've got the lunar sorcerers who I think I would call Gold Moon, for those who are familiar with the books, maybe like a lunar sorcerer of the full moon. Some might disagree. She's almost cleric-y, but you know, those full moon sorcerers are sort of cleric-y. Anyway, then we move on to Sturm Brightblade, the Knight of Salamnia. So down.
His name is Sturm.
Sturm, I know.
Sturm.
It's not my fault.
So
a great name.
I'm not gonna lie. Oh gosh, yeah. I don't have a lot of experience with these books or anything. So I just think of this as like a knight's order where they're passing down like a butcher's secret of how to make the best salami. That's how I read it. So
Knights of Salami.
The Knights of Salami. So anyways, this background, you start out with athletics and survival as your skill proficiency. A tool, you get to choose a musical instrument as something you're proficient in, and then a language of your choosing. And then you get some random equipment. You get a insignia of your rank in the order. You get a deck of cards, some normal common clothes, and 10 gold. So nothing crazy.
Welcome to the order. Here's an insignia with your rank, a deck of cards, common clothes, and 10 gold. What? Yep. It's like, where do the cards come into play? Aren't we supposed to be knights?
I guess you just get bored, you know, on the march. You got to have some.
It's part of the hazing ritual. They don't tell you what they use the deck of cards for.
Yep.
Give them to you and say, hold on to these. Trust me, you're going to want them later.
But what is cool with this background is it comes with a feat. It comes with the Squire of Salamnia, Squire of Salami feat, which is cool. So kind of looking at this, I think this is probably a good background for fighters or paladins. And then you also get to have a trinket, and there's like a little roll table for it. So,
okay, let's get to those feats in a second. I'll explain the Mage of High Sorcery background, which is probably like the most famous, I guess I would argue, character from the Dragonlance books is a mage by the name of Raistlin. He is a twin he's like this kind of brittle, frail mage. And at first he's like neutral. So he's like the red moon. And his twin brother is like a big fighter barbarian type, right? But Raistlin is kind of this mage of high sorcery. So the mage of high sorcery you know, they've got skill proficiencies, languages, equipment, etc. But then, you know, they also get a free feat. So they get their free feat is called the Initiate of High Sorcery feat. And then, you know, you get like free lodging and food with, you know, other high sorcery locales, if you find them in the world. And similarly, you know, they get, you've got your suggested personality traits, your trinkets, things like that, that all backgrounds tend to get, right? So aside from the free feat, for both of these backgrounds, they function very similarly to other backgrounds in D&D, right? But because of that free feat, it has a tendency to sort of push these more towards, I think, what we see with the Ravnica backgrounds, right? And I think for that reason, they could potentially be problematic. So let's talk about those here really quick.
Yeah, because you can't really talk about, like, you have to get into the feats of them before you can really make a judgment call. Because on the surface, it's like, that's a normal background.
Yeah, but it comes with a free feat, which most other backgrounds get. Okay, well, how powerful is the feat? Before I know if I'm going to allow this at my table, right? Let's discuss. So tell us, Dallin, tell us about the feats that are associated with the knights, not only the Squire of Salamnia, but the other ones, right?
So right off the bat, you get that Squire of Salamnia feat. It gives you proficiency with medium armor and martial weapons. So nothing too crazy.
I think you mean medium armor.
Yes, medium armor. You get to wear a salami infused full plate. You get
that sounds delicious.
Full plate of salami.
Yes, you get advantage. No,
it's
just rolls.
Half plate. It's medium armor. Full plate's heavy.
Oh right.
Sorry. Oh, okay. All right.
It's one of those weird, like, disc half moon shaped plates.
Yeah, it's just charcuterie on the chest.
We'll call it a charcuterie.
It's a half plate of meat and a half plate of pickles and cheese.
Who wouldn't want to eat that off of someone's chest?
I mean, depends on the
now
chest.
Now it got weird. It was already weird.
What else am I good for if not to make things weird?
Okay, back on the rails, I guess. You get advantage on rolls to stay on your mount. Ooh. Which I just can't think of a time that you're really going to need that, but maybe if you're doing like a mounted campaign, it's helpful.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you want to go with like a cavalier fighter as your subclass, like eventually your DM is going to be like, okay, it's time to see if we can dismount this character and make them fight on the ground.
I think cavaliers already have that though as part of their subclass.
They might, yeah.
Anyway.
Lastly, you can use your reaction to give advantage to an ally within 30 feet on a saving throw. Proficiency times per day, but that's pretty cool. So pretty solid starting feat.
It's actually once.
Oh, is it once? Once per day. Sorry, everything else in here is proficiency times per day. So once per day.
The only prerequisite for this feat is squireship in the Knights of Salamnia. I don't know that necessarily means you have to take the Squire of Salamnia background. Does it?
I think the Knight of Salamnia background is implied with this feat. That's how I read it.
I guess I'm wondering, because of this prerequisite, it seems to me like if I didn't want to take that background, I still might be able to get this feat. I would just have to like clear it with my DM. Hey,
can I join the rank?
Well, like, honestly, that would be great to be like level one. I want to have like the thief background, but I want to be somebody who wants to be better at this, so I want to join the Knights of Salamnia. You know, maybe I want some of that good charcuterie and I want to get in with them. And so, like, maybe around level four, that's when you pick up the feat, and then level eight, you can get into and become a full knight or whatever it is.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, as feats go, just by itself, if it wasn't given to you for free by choosing a background, it's not amazing.
I don't think anybody would go out of their way to pick it unless it was given to you.
proficiency with medium armor and martial weapons, like, okay, that
fighting
that can come in handy for sure if you didn't want to take like a multi-class dip somewhere else to get that or whatever, right? Like getting both medium armor and martial weapon proficiency in a single feat, that's not bad. It's not amazing. You could get it fairly easily by doing like a fighter dip or something, but maybe you don't have a 13 strength or dexterity for that fighter dip and you don't, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Advantage on saving throws made to avoid falling off a mount. Not going to be used much, I don't think. Encouraging rally, though, is, you know,
that's kind of cool.
It's decent. I mean, you can only do it once a day, but you know, advantage on a save. So yeah, it's kind of like, okay, it's not amazing, but yeah, there's some usefulness there. I could see it maybe coming in handy for a certain.
It's kind of like a baby, paladin feat.
Sure.
Like kind of just,
mama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Made it weird again.
But then we get some additional feats, right? That do require that you take the Squire of Salamnia feat first, right? So tell us about these knights. Yeah.
So there's three orders of the knights. I'm just pulling them up here. So basically you have the there's the Knight of the Crown, the Knight of the Sword, and the Knight of the Rose. So I'll just kind of cover these. So Knight of the Crown, there's some prerequisites. You have to be fourth level and you have to be a Squire of Salamnia. You have to have that feat already. So with the Knight of the Crown, you get to increase your strength or dex by one. And then you get something called tactical teamwork. You use your reaction to give an ally advantage within 5 feet on an attack roll. And you can do that proficiency times per long rest.
Right.
That was pretty cool. It's kind of on par with a lot of those like half feats that we've seen where you get a little bit of a bump and then something. Mm-hmm.
That's not bad. I mean, a bonus action, you get multiple uses. You can use it on yourself. You know, advantage a few times a day. Okay, plus a half feat. That's pretty good.
Not bad.
But you have to take the Squire Salamnia feat first.
Right.
And that, so there's a it's tied to something else, which kind of makes me go. Mm-hmm.
Unless it's your background.
Unless it's your background. Yeah,
unless it's your background, then you're building on it. Yep, which is cool. So then the other one, Knight of the Sword, again, the prerequisites are the same, fourth level, and you've taken the Squire feat. So this one, you get proficiency in either intelligence, wisdom, or charisma saving throws. And then when you see an ally within 30 feet fail a saving throw, either intelligence, wisdom, or charisma, you can expend a hit dice to add that to their roll. Once you've turned a failure into a success, then you can't use it again until a long rest, but you can keep attempting it proficiency times per day.
I like that. There's not enough stuff that deals with hit dice, in my opinion. I think that having extra things that kind of interact with the hit dice is really cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty nice because, well, I mean, okay, proficiency in intelligence, wisdom, or charisma saving throws, that's like one of these things is not like the others. Like, you know, intelligence and charisma saving throws come up fairly rarely for
wisdom
players, but wisdom saving throws come up all the time, right?
Yeah.
And so if you didn't want to take resilient wisdom, or maybe you took resilient constitution earlier and now you still want wisdom saving throw proficiency, right? Here's a way to get it. It's not a half feat like the resilient feat is, but you do get something else that's nice. You know, this kind of bump to a saving throw that you can use for yourself or an ally. That's pretty nice. And I like that you can basically keep using it until you turn a failure into a success. So it's not wasted if you know, you try and it fails. That's kind of
cool.
Now, this next one is a seal song, right?
Yes,
I compare you to a knight of the rose on the grave.
Something to that effect. Yeah, so Knight of the Rose. Again, same prerequisites, fourth level, squire feat. This one, you increase your constitution or charisma by one. And then when you roll initiative, you can choose three other creatures that you can see within 30 feet, and each creature can gain temporary hit points based on a roll of your hit die, plus your proficiency, plus the ability modifier that you increased with this feat. Wow. And you can do that proficiency times per long rest. So that one's kind of new. I don't think there's really a lot of other features like that in the game. That's kind of new and
that's
kind
a
of
lot, something. That's a lot of temporary hit points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is.
I mean, your hit die plus your proficiency bonus plus the ability modifier, three creatures. It only costs you, well, no, it just happens when you roll initiative. Yeah. You don't even have to use a bonus action or anything.
Yep.
And proficiency bonus number of times per day, plus it's a half feat.
Yeah, yeah, I think one of the things to keep in mind, though, is you have to, it has to be when you roll initiative, right?
Which is how many times is that happening at your table? Could be one or two, but it could be three or four.
Well, so in other words, like probably for most tables, every single time you have a combat encounter, three of you are going to get a lot of temporary hit points to start the fight with. And that's really good considering that I also got to bump my constitution by one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I can see them reining that in.
Yeah. I think this one might get
overpowered to me.
This one might get reined back a little bit. This one seems strong.
You know, when I first was reading about the Knights of Salamnia in particular, I was like, a background that gives a free feat. Like, I don't think this is going to go over well. Like, I think that's, I don't like it when backgrounds are very clearly give a mechanical advantage than another background. It makes it feel to me like, well, if this is available to take, then like, I'm always going to take it because, you know, or at least I'm very strongly encouraged or motivated to take it,
right?
Than some other background because it's a free feat. And other backgrounds don't give bonuses, except for like in Strixhaven. And if you guys recall when we talked about the Strixhaven book, right, I think we all felt fairly unanimous that like this is all pretty balanced stuff except for like these backgrounds that just give you all of these spells. And it's like, unless you are playing in a Strixhaven specific campaign and or everybody else took a Strixhaven background, like we're not going to allow it at the table because it's just it gives a level of power that other backgrounds don't, and that's not
right.
And the Knights of Salamnia one is kind of like that, but it's not as egregious, I don't think. The free feat is still a free feat, but it's not an amazing feat. And then the other things that build on it, maybe with the exception of the Knights of the Rose, aren't super amazing either, in my opinion. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it kind of goes on what you're trying to build towards, right?
Yeah.
But I think there are feats that exist, these other half feats that have already come out that might be better.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if we see these feats either get tweaked, maybe the crown and the sword bumped up a little and the rose pulled back a little. Yeah. I'm not sure, but
okay.
Nothing crazy.
We're going long as we always do.
There's a lot to cover.
Yeah, there is. Let's talk really briefly before we get into the sorcery feats. There was one feat that was like unaffiliated and two. So divinely favored, God has chosen you to carry a spark of their divine power. You learn the Thaumaturgy cantrip and one first level spell based on the alignment of your character. This is interesting. You can cast the chosen first level spell without a spell slot once per day, like everything lately. And then if you have spell slots, then you can use it, you know, kind of thing. I love the versatility of the spell casting ability for this feat. Spell is intelligence, wisdom, and charisma. Now, this is interesting. The first level spell that you can choose, if your alignment is evil, you can choose a first level warlock or wizard spell. If it's good, a first level cleric or wizard spell. If it's neutral, a first level druid or wizard spell. And that's pretty powerful. I mean, I guess I should say that's pretty unique anyway, right? I mean, there are things like this that sort of exist already. You've got, you know, magic initiate feat where you can pick a first level spell from pretty much any class, but that's like, if it's from the druid spell list, you have to use wisdom, right, to cast this spell. Or if it's from the warlock spell list, you have to use charisma. This really just kind of opens up options a little bit for us, I think, here. Now, there are things like Fey Touched and Shadow Touched that give you options to pick a first level spell, but that's not from an entire spell list, right? It's just, it's only whatever, Illusion and Necromancy in the Shadow Touched example.
And that's so that's not an insignificant amount of spells though, already, right? Two different spell schools out of eight, and, I think.
And with Shadow Touched and Fey Touched, you also get a second level spell. It's very specifically Misty Step or Illusion, right? But so, you know, the power level here doesn't feel too off to me. It's just nice to kind of have a little more variety. If there's a first level spell that I really, really want, and I want to be able to cast it with like intelligence, even though it's on the druid spell list, you know, or whatever, like it's nice to kind of be like, okay, I can get it now with this feat. Divine Communications requires that you take the Divinely Favored feat first, so it does have a prerequisite. And then basically it's a half feat, so you get to increase, you know, your spell casting ability basically by one, which is great. And then you learn to speak, read, and write Celestial plus two other languages, and then you can cast augury and commune spell without a spell slot. And then you have to finish a D4 long rest before you can cast it in this way again, but then of course you can use spell slots to cast it, and it uses the spell casting ability that you chose, blah blah blah, right? So this to me is kind of okay, like if I were creating a character that was really into you know, speaking with their gods or prophesying or things like that, you know, it totally makes sense. Otherwise it feels a lot more sort of flavor.
We utility. Know that you wouldn't pick this for any of your builds. Like you there's so many other feats that you would go with that have more benefits for you. I'm actually a little disappointed at the Divine Omens portion.
Yeah.
I wish that it was only once and then you have to do the D4. I don't like being able to use spell slots to do it again. I like the idea that like you're connected with them, but it's a connection that isn't always there, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a really cool, the first part's really cool where it's like, oh yeah, you can only talk to them once every 1 to 4 days kind of thing, and you have a conversation with them. And then it's like, unless you're a sorcerer, then you could just do it whenever you want.
Yeah.
No thanks.
Yeah. So, you know, interesting, flavorful, not particularly overpowered, I don't think. But then let's talk, and I'll try and keep this brief, about the feats that come with the, you know, the high sorcery,
the high mage, high sorcerer,
right? Or the mage of high sorcery. So the free feat that they get is the initiative high sorcery. And yeah, this was a free feat that you got from your background, and similar to the Ravnica ones, like I have a problem with it, I guess. I mean, you choose one of the three moons, and then based on the moon that you choose, you get free spells. Basically, you get cantrips, you get to choose from a list of cantrips and choose from a list of first level spells. And I don't need to go into the list, but you also get to choose the spell casting ability that you use for these spells. And so it really opens up, and creates some versatility and diversity, which I love. But yeah, like if this background were allowed at my table, I feel like I would just pick it on every character.
Yeah, you would have to
just always play a mage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or no, that's, play that's a fighter. The thing is like, and then
right. And then now you can
have some spells, cast spells, right?
So you make a really good gish.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's only level spell, but yeah, it just.
I think you need to preface all these with saying like, they need to be in a world where the high sorcerers exist, right? Because can't just be like, because if somebody came up to me and they're like, hey, I want my background to be the Golgari Guild from Ravnica, I'll be like, well, we're not really on Ravnica, are we? Right. I'm not sure. Like, I would want to work with you to find out why you want to play it, and if it's just so that you can get the benefits without having to like, because like to me, you pick a background to inform what your character is and who they were before they became an adventurer.
Yeah.
And if your only reason for picking Golgari or picking the initiative high sorcery is because you like the spells, then it's one of those things where it's like, you need to pick a different background. We're not allowing this stuff.
And I, like, of course, I'm sure that, you know, most people are like, well, it's fine. Like if this is overpowered or whatever, then like, just don't allow it at your table and it's not a big deal. I guess it just it I feel like I'm a cat having my fur rubbed like the wrong way. Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, no, like Wizards of the Coast, if you're gonna put content out, like make it balanced so that it works like across the multiverse, and don't make it so that like we're very, very encouraged to only use this particular feature or whatever if you're going to play in the world of Kryn, because maybe our campaign doesn't take place in the world of Kryn, and now I feel like you've created content that I'm not going to be able to use. You know what I mean?
I think it's might be indicative of the future of what we're going to see, though.
Yeah.
Because they might just like basically from every publication here on out just start including free feet with every background.
Yeah.
Here's your spell list. And if that's what they're doing, then fine, because at least it's balanced going forward.
Right.
But it's like we're in this like awkward stage if that's what they're doing, where we're like, this kind of doesn't work all the time. So I don't know. Right. We'll have to see what they do in their next couple of releases.
I think Colby just doesn't like it because he gets a lot of comments on his video. Why didn't you take this feat and you wouldn't have to multi-class?
That's partly true, because I do. Yeah. And I have to always explain, well, I've kind of decided to not use the Ravnica backgrounds because I think most tables don't allow them unless they're specifically playing in Ravnica, right? Very quickly, I'll just go over like the Adept of the Black Robes, Adept of the Red Robes, and Adept of the White Robes. They're all very similar. You know, you have to have they have a prerequisite, which is, you know, to take this initiate feat first, similar to the Knights, right? And then you get, basically you get a second level spell of your choice that comes from, you know, a certain school of magic, depending on, you know, if you're black, red, or white. And then
you can cast it once for free.
Right. You can cast it once for free, and then you can use spell slots otherwise if you have them. The spell casting ability is the one chosen when you gain the initiative, high sorcery feat, etc. And then they get, you know, something else. So for the Black Robes, life channel, you can channel your life force into the power of your magic. When a creature you can see within 60 feet of you fails on a saving throw against a spell you cast, you can expend a number of hit dice. Again, Corey, like you were saying, right? A way to use hit dice equal to the level of the spell. You can empower your spell with your own hit dice to make it do more damage if they fail a saving throw. And it's just on one creature. So you couldn't do fireball and now everybody takes bonus damage. But I love this because there are so few ways in fifth edition to increase the power, or at least the damage anyway, of spells, especially saving throw based spells. And so this is very unique, and it costs you, you know, you're going to have to spend your own potential to heal yourself later.
Mm-hmm.
So I just like
bring a lot of potions.
Feels very flavorful and also just unique and something that's cool and different and potentially powerful. It's not a ton of damage that you'd be adding, but
no. So. Yeah. And to be, to clarify, I don't know if you said this, but you roll a number of hit dice equal to half the number that you expended. Because at level 20, you get 20 hit dice. So the max you could do would be 10. Right.
Right.
And if you're a wizard already, it's basically like giving a spell smite to every class, like every wizard.
It's class. A less emo blood hunter.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it doesn't necessarily do damage to you. It just reduces your ability to heal later potentially. Yeah. But if you're going to be taking a long rest, then it might not matter. So the power level of this feat almost fluctuates based on how many combat encounters you tend to have at your table per long rest and or per short rest for that matter.
How much healing you've got from other characters, how many, like I said, how many potions that you might be able to have on your hand,
right?
I think
So that's cool. The Red Robes one, again, same kind of thing, second level spell, limited spell schools, but then they also get when you make an attack, so magical balance, when you make an attack roll, an ability check, or a saving throw and roll a 9 or lower on the d20, you can use your reaction to treat the roll as a 10. You can use this reaction a number of times equal to your proficiency bonus times per day. So that, I think, is the most powerful of all of these. I'd be surprised if it saw the light of day in its current form. I hope it does, because I think it's amazing. So an attack roll, an ability check, or a saving throw is automatically a 10 proficiency bonus times per day with your reaction.
Yep.
That's really good.
Not bad.
You're
not
basically bad really guaranteeing good. Yeah, success on saving throws or success on hitting somebody.
And the fact that it scales with your character level, right? As you level up.
Yeah.
It's really good. And I want it. The White Robes one, again, same thing, second level spell. Limited spell scrolls, but then they get protective ward. So when you or a creature you can see within 30 feet of you takes damage, you use your reaction, you expend a spell slot, and basically you roll a number of d4s equal to the level of the spell slot expended and reduce the damage the target takes. So it's sort of like an absorbing mechanic, right? Plus your spell casting modifier. Sort of like the interception fighting style. But for a spellcaster. So it's cool. I'm not quite sure. Number of D4s equal to the level of spell slot plus your spellcasting modifier. That's kind of pricey to spend a spell slot.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. If it was like a D6, it'd be nicer. I think D4 is a little bit low on the dice there, but I do like it for something like an Eldritch Knight or something that is a defender most of the time. I know a particular artificer who doesn't like using their spell slots because they like saving it for protection stuff, and this would work really well for that.
Yeah, I would think that. I don't know. I kind of feel like this might need just a little bump, in the power level. But I mean, I can only ever imagine using a first level spell slot for this, right? Because 1d4 or 2d4, I mean, that's an extra 2.5. The real meat of the protection is coming from your spellcasting ability modifier. Yeah. And I'd be loath to spend high level spell slots to get an extra d4 or two, right?
Yeah. If it was d6, it is, that's maybe better. Maybe even a D8.
I don't know. But it's
just bump it up to D20s. We'll take all of the overpoweredness from Magical Balance and we'll just throw it in. We'll just roll it out to 10.
Yeah. So anyway, that was our long-winded deep dive into the Unearthed Arcana, the Heroes of Kryn. I'm just going to end it because it's late and I got to get home and make dinner. So,
what are you making?
I don't know yet. Yeah. Are we invited? Figure that out. No.
Oh, okay. That's fine. I have a game to prep for tonight.
That's game day. Woo-hoo. I'll probably make egg burritos. Actually, let's be honest. I'm just going to take the kids out to dinner. Anyway, love you guys.
Appreciate your honesty.
For watching, and love you guys too, my DMs.
So glad to be back.
For being here. Yeah, it's been fun. I've missed this for sure. We'll see you soon. Thanks, you guys, for helping me out and joining me, and we'll see you in a couple of hours to play some D&D.
Yeah. Woo-woo. See ya.
Take care. Somebody say something stupid.
Something stupid.
I was going to say that I enjoy second edition way more than any other edition. You wanted something stupid.
I'm deleting you.
Mostly I say inappropriate things, but I don't mean to be inappropriate.
Okay, somebody say something inappropriate.
I am in my closet right now, and it's not what you think it is. I'm legit in my closet.
I am not in the closet, and it is what you think it is.
I perfect. Saw so many people on my trip.
Okay, let's clarify. Tori went to Italy and was seeing a lot of art. Oh, I'm totally gonna put that in. I'm just gonna mute the volume. How do I usually sign off?
It's been so long. Stay safe. Love each other.
Dylan, I thought you were gonna say stay sexy, and I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, that's fine. Stay sexy, viewers.
That's the new sign-off.